Rodney King was found dead on June 16th in his home swimming pool. As you probably remember, he became famous in 1991 when he was videotaped being beaten by members of the Los Angeles police following a high-speed car chase. When the four white officers were acquitted of assault and use of excessive force, riots broke out in South Central L.A. and raged for 5 days. I spoke with Mr. King and his fiancée, Cynthia Kelly, on April 25th when his memoir, The Riot Within, My Journey from Rebellion to Redemption, was published by Harper One. He spoke openly and movingly about his struggle with alcohol addiction and his physical recovery from the incident that had made him a household name. We are remembering him by airing part of that interview now. During the riots in 1992, Rodney King went on television and made an appeal for peace, uttering his famous words, "People, can't we get along?" When he was here, I asked him about that moment.
That came from the heart. That came straight from the heart.
But your lawyers had scripted something very different for you to say, hadn't they?
Yeah, they gave me a list of things to say, you know, and I didn't want to read all that, what they had written down. I just gave it back to him to my head. I'll do it from my heart.
Well, yours were a lot more conciliatory than what they wanted you to read.
Oh yeah.
Well, Cynthia, you didn't know Rodney at the time, right?
Correct.
But when you saw him say that, there were a lot of people in the African American community who were upset that he was being so conciliatory. They wanted words of outrage from him.
Correct.
What were people saying to you?
Basically, when he said, "Can we all get along?" they were wondering why he was so real low key. As the fact, why wasn't it we deserve justice, no peace, justice, no peace? And in his heart, he was saying, we can have peace if we all stop and just try to get along and work this out through the justice system itself.
Can you take us through the events that led up to the beating? Why didn't you just pull over when you heard the police siren?
You know, I knew I was on parole, and I had been working for a temporary job at Dodger Stadium, remodeling some of the hot dog stands, and then got on as an usher. But my other job called me back to for bridge construction, and I was so happy that the union job called me. So whatever it took to be on that job Monday, I was willing to do it. And, you know, that Friday, I think that Saturday earlier in the day, I went over to a friend's house and we had popped a couple of cold ones. And after we was there for a little while, I decided to go to a lake where my dad used to take us fishing. And I got on the freeway and I knew I'd been drinking and I was speeding a little bit. And that was wrong, you know. And
thought they were, if they pulled you over, you're on parole, you have this job that you might lose as a result. So, but you did the crazy thing. You took them on an 8-mile chase, was it?
Yeah, to try and get away so I can be at work Monday, and it didn't work. That was a foolish mistake.
What do you remember the officers saying to you?
Well, Melanie Singer, and there was a husband and wife team. She walked over. She got my ID, and I knew most of the time after chase, all the time, normally the person driving is going to get, you're going to get a beating. And I just didn't know how bad it was going to be. That's one of the reasons why I was looking for a safe spot to pull over at. And so I finally pull over. She got my ID. She's walking away from me. As she's walking away, I can see them get hyper and running, popping in the trunk and grabbing a taser and grabbing the billy clubs, running towards me. As she walked away, her husband had just walked up to me, and I'm face down on the ground, and he kicked me in the temple. I don't know if that was the point where he busted my cheekbone and caved my temple in, knocked my eye socket out. I've got a plate in my eye socket to this day and my cheekbone.
I have to say that they did really great work on you, Rodney.
Oh, yeah, my heart goes out to
my doctors. One would never know, but I remember the photos. At the time, I thought, it's impossible to put this guy back together.
Yeah, I had a lot of people praying for me too, and that's what helped me a lot. But there's also some tremendous doctors. So Coon, the sergeant, comes over and shoots me with a taser, discharge that taser, and they start wailing on me. And then he asked me, how do you feel now? I couldn't say nothing, and then he goes, we're going to kill you, nigga, run. That's when I laid down flat on the ground and just paused for a minute. When I heard that, I already know it's time to run. It's time to get away. And when I got up to run, I didn't know my leg was broke.
Did you, how long was the physical recovery from your injuries?
Oh, it's still physical.
You still suffer from something?
I still suffer from headaches from that beating to this day and nightmares.
Well, I would not assume that you had PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder.
For a long time, I was having nightmares and couldn't sleep. You know, would wake up having to just take a walk and catch my breath. Because it went on for like years after that, even after it had passed.
Did you go into psychological therapy?
Yeah, it helped. It helped a little. It helped a little, but I had to, you know, get it in my head that I'm gonna have to fight this thing myself.
When did you first hear that the beating had been caught on videotape?
There was a sheriff inside the jail, and she said, "Oh, baby, just get yourself well, get healthy, and get out of here, because we seen everything on videotape. It's all on videotape. They got them." And when she said that, I was holding on to my shoes and a piece of my shirt, because it had blood all over it. I was going to use that for evidence. And so when she told me that, it was a big relief, you know.
What kind of shape were you in physically and mentally at the start of the first trial?
Emotionally, I was just torn up apart, and physically, I was also still hadn't really fully recovered. I was still having migraine headaches, and what made it worse was when I was told to stay home, not to testify in my own trial.
Yeah, why do you think your lawyers made that decision?
It was a real immature decision on their part as lawyers. It almost seemed like they wanted all the attention to be on themselves, you know, and instead of fighting the case.
Now, how did the attorneys for the police explain the video footage, which, you know, is kind of self-explanatory? Yeah. It's a police riot.
Well, that was the problem. It was too real, too raw to believe, to think that these policemen was just out just doing this for no reason. It's like this guy, they had to have a reason. I had to have given them a reason to do this, because they knew that it was a big embarrassment to law enforcement, not just in LA, but all over the world. And what happened was, it was too real. It was just, it was a godsend that video happened to be there at that time. And
right, you just would have wound up in the hospital and perhaps in jail, yeah. And that would have been the end of it.
Our would have died. They would have killed me off the rest of the way. And that's one of the reasons why I'm glad, you know, the civil rights movement was like it was years ago, because it helped me in my case later on, you know, in the 90s, with all the work that, you know, civil rights people have done and died for, black and white in this country. It really set a trail for me.
Did you have any doubt that the officers would be found guilty?
Yeah, once they moved it to Simi Valley, outside of Los Angeles, where it happened. It had happened so many times in Los Angeles, they knew that they wouldn't win that case in Los Angeles. So that's one of the main reasons why it went to Simi Valley.
I was going to explain why trial being moved to Simi Valley was significant, but we have a listener who wrote in, Professor Robert Hodge of Nassau Community College, and he says that the trial was transferred to Simi Valley, which has the highest percentage of retired police officers and firemen. Now, were many of them on the jury?
I believe that at least five of them were.
Well, how did you wind up meeting Rodney, Cynthia?
I was selected to be on the trial for the civil suit.
That was the second trial.
The second trial. And I was one of the jurors on the trial. And that's the case where Daryl Gates had to actually come in and testify for the brutality that was gone in the Los Angeles Police Department for many years. And so I was at that trial. And then after the trial, Rodney King asked his lawyer to, can he introduce me to him?
You spotted her in the jury. Yeah. And found her attractive.
Yeah.
Were you surprised?
Yeah. I was really surprised, because my first reaction was, why does he want to meet me?
How is he different from the person that's been portrayed in the news media?
He's a very, very nice, generous, compassionate man, and he is very supportive to me, and he's a loving man.
And Rodney, you say you're a forgiving man.
Oh yeah. Definitely.
Have you forgiven the officers who beat you? Can you?
Oh yeah. It's like this. So, you have to look at the whole picture, you know, I wouldn't want to go to bed angry, and you know, being angry just puts ulcers, and you can't think straight to do your job. You know, I couldn't live my life out right if I was always not forgiving. You know, I've been forgiven many times.
Do you think it's better in LA now?
Things have changed, and I try to do my part in always making it different from yesterday and setting a positive trail and leaving a positive note for the next generation. I'm always, because America's been good to me, you know, despite the bullcrap that races and the bullying that goes on. For the most of it, I've met some real, real wonderful people since then.
So what was your reaction when you heard about the killing of Trayvon Martin, that teenager in Florida?
It's just another thing where, you know, it's easy to kill a black man, a black kid also these days, and get away with it because it's been going on so long. And so now it's like in the hands of I don't want to say what I want to say, but it's in the hands of people that are half crazy, that's still into violence and think viciously, which is totally wrong. It's not the American way. You know, that's not the way I was raised and not the way I look upon my country. But the tone is set. The tone is set to over the years, and we got to get away from that. Whatever it takes to, and he deserves justice. His family, he's gone now, but his family deserves justice.
Well, Cynthia, with the Trayvon Martin case, white America's heard about the talk that happens between many African-American adults and children. Were you given that talk when you were growing up?
Everybody here get that one.
Actually, I have been very lucky in my life. I've always lived in areas where it wasn't predominantly black, and I lived where all my friends were either, you know, different races. And I just always believed that everyone is accountable for their own actions, no matter what color they are. And if we can get along as friends, that's the best thing that we can do in our lives.
But you, Rodney, you suggest you were given the talk.
Oh, yeah, I was given a talk. And I think most males around my age have been given a talk. You make yourself likable. You be very respectful and respect people. And, you know, hold the door for your older people. And that's the way I was raised, you know.
I remember my grandmother, she used to clean houses for white people.
And get
at the
out
time,
of
no, at the time, I didn't. I said, Grandma, they're not the same color as us. And she said, it's okay, baby. They're going to pay me at the end of the day.
Yeah, it was good old days.
So I said, oh, okay. But I said, you know what? I don't want to clean people's houses. I want to own the house.
Now, Rodney, what did you do with the $3.8 million settlement you received?
Yeah, I received
it. Did you buy a house?
Yeah, absolutely. What I did was I bought myself a house. You know, I came out with about a million dollars. So I bought myself a house. I bought my mom a house. And I needed to buy my mom a house to take care of her. That made me feel good. I had legal bills I had to take care of. I had hospital bills. I still have hospital bills to this day. And, you know, I had huge hospital bills in the breaking the broken eye socket, which required a plate in back of it, the broken cheekbone. And, you know, I still suffer from headaches from that beating to this day.
Well, you've also had some run-ins with the police.
Absolutely.
Since the 1990s, mostly alcohol-related. Were you self-medicating, do you think?
You know, I was just didn't know how to deal with almost getting killed by the police, and had a different way of dealing with my issues than most people. And it took some time, you know, to grow up, because, I mean, I was a young adult when that happened to me. So it over the years, it took its toll on me, you know. Everybody had a breaking point, and mine was alcohol at the time. And that's one of the reasons why I'm glad I, you know, went to some of the NAAA meetings that I went to over the years, because I learned a lot from people, not just my psychologists and stuff like that and the doctors, but going to some of those programs was a good thing, because I was able to learn the effects that alcohol have on a male's body, you know.
And then you appeared on Dr. Drew's Celebrity Rehab for 2 seasons, also on its companion show, Sober House.
Yeah, they reached out to me, and I was really appreciative.
So you're totally sober now?
No, I'm not totally sober. I still drink. I just don't drink like I used to. You know, I sip, and that's it, you know.
That's the hardest thing, actually, for somebody in AA. So how do you spend your days now? Are you working?
Well, I've been promoting my book. I've been writing for the last, you know, past two years. Spend a lot of time with family now, and, you know, just really running all over town promoting this book. Sometimes from 4 in the morning to almost 11 o'clock at night, and that's a job itself right now, you know. So
and Cynthia, you're smiling because you have to go along with all of that.
No, I mean, it's true. And then he likes to fish. He goes fishing a lot.
Yeah.
He's an avid swimmer. He likes to surf.
Mm-hmm. Well, have you ever thought of leaving Los Angeles, moving to another city?
Yeah, I have thought about it. I've left Los Angeles for a little while, but it's like, that's my home. It's like,
well, I've always found LA is a nice place to visit, but I wouldn't want to live there.
Yeah.
As they say.
I would want to live in New York.
Huh?
I would want to live out here.
Yeah, you guys live. That's why I moved on the outskirts of LA, because I thought they was fast. But out here, man, you guys.
Too fast.
For any listeners that have never been to New York or plan to come to New York, you have to come. It is amazing. They have people that will just walk in the middle of the street as you're driving down the street in a car, and they will not move out of the way.
We love New York.
Oh, you saw me this morning.
it's crazy.
Thank you both so much for being on our show. Rodney King, he's written a book about his experiences with the help of Lawrence J. Spinola, published by Harper One. He's been here along with his fiancée, Cynthia Kelly.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.